The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, love you, man. You're all we got in Philadelphia.
Hi, Chris. I love your show.
I love your show. And I have to say my wife, who's a Democrat, also loves your show.
Good morning, Chris. Always enjoy your show.
We must increase vaccinations among the unvaccinated with new vaccination requirements. With nearly 80 million eligible Americans who have not gotten vaccinated, many said they were waiting for approval from the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Well, last month, the FDA granted that approval. So the time for waiting is over. This summer, we made progress through the combination of vaccine requirements and incentives, as well as the FDA approval. 4 million more people got their first shot in August than they did in July. But we need to do more. This is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Good morning, Philadelphia friends and foes. This is Christine Flowers sitting in one last time for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Chris will be back on Monday. And can I say that this is a bittersweet moment for me, because although it will be good not to have to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning yet again, I will miss being across from Eddie Caiazzo. I will miss being in this studio and talking to everybody. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning, Christine.
It's so good to see you. I have to tell everybody, Eddie greeted me with flowers this morning. Flowers for flowers. It was, I'm going to take a picture of it and I'm going to put it on Facebook. It was just, it's just the so sweetest thing. And I'm verklempt. Thank you so much. So, gosh, I really don't know what we're going to talk about today, Eddie. There's nothing happened overnight.
No. You know, it was, I guess, the start of NFL football.
Yeah.
We're a day away from the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and by the way,
I know.
The federal government is...
Your child got the vaccine. Yavol. Oh, yeah. Well, that was, it was both shocking and not unexpected. I think so many people saw the writing on the wall. You know, you go from telling people that the vaccine is a good thing to suggesting strongly that they take it, to requiring that they take it, to punishing them if they don't take it. It is a not so gradual devolution here. You know, the person behind this mic is someone who has had the vaccine, and I got it as soon as I was eligible for it. I got both shots of the Moderna vaccine. And I'll tell you, that second shot really, really laid me low for a couple of days. But I got the shot. I do not at all regret having gotten the shot. And if you ask me, should I get it, I would strongly suggest that you get it. I personally would say to you, I think it's a good idea for you to get the shot. That is very different from what Joe Biden did yesterday. And let's break it down a little bit. He did two things. he mandated that all federal workers, with a little asterisk exception there.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that in a second. That they be vaccinated. What he also did, and I will say, although I vehemently disagree with it, and I do think that there is a legal problem with that overarching mandate, particularly because of the exception that he carved out. I do think, you know, a president does have wide and sweeping executive authority to mandate that federal workers comply with certain OSHA regulations. Now, the problem with what he did with the federal mandate, you know, beside the fact that he's basically telling employees to do something with their bodies that they might not otherwise want to do, you know, my body, my choice. What happened with that? Fully, I believe in women's reproductive rights, Catholic Joe Biden. The problem is he carved out a fairly sweeping exception for postal workers. Now, if you think about federal workers, and Eddie, I mean, I don't have a list of federal workers, but if you think about federal workers, the first thing that pops into your mind when you hear postal worker is, oh, yeah, they go to homes. They're the ones who are on the first line in contact with other people. So the fact that they are exempt from this mandate is really bizarre, unless you consider that the Postal Workers Union was a huge, strong supporter of President Biden. Do you have any idea why he would have carved out that particular exception, Eddie?
Logically, for me, other than the union's strength, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, that is the only thing that I can think of. It makes no sense. No. He says, you know, this sweeping mandate. Why? Are postal workers, do they have some kind of special kryptonite that makes them particularly immune to the coronavirus, to COVID, so they don't need this vaccine? What is it about postal workers? You know, these are the people who are supposed to go through rain, through snow, through sleet, through fire, through whatever. They can't take a vaccine. Is there a problem with them? But beyond the federal mandate, we have something that I think is infinitely more troubling, because a president does have sweeping authority in the federal realm. And I use the word realm advisedly, because now it seems like we have an emperor at the head of the government here. But the other part of his announcement was that any company with 100 or more employees, private company with 100 or more employees, was going to have to mandate that their employees get the vaccine or they would be fired. Now, I unfortunately think that many of these private companies are actually secretly thrilled about this, because it gets them off the hook. They may have wanted, you know, these woke companies may have wanted to mandate to have some kind of vaccine mandate, but felt that they couldn't do it, that they would lose workers, that, you know, for whatever reason, they weren't able to put that in place. And now they've got the cover of the federal government. The federal government is saying, yeah, you can do this. Yeah, you can strong arm your employees.
Oh, you will.
Exactly. Well, I mean, like in their secret little conversations, like we're going to pretend that we're making you do this, but we know you really want to do it anyway. You know?
Here's the way.
Right.
I got it.
I'm sounding like a female Fauci. We know you want to do it, but you'll do it anyway. So the and I find that to be egregious, really, to the extent that it's so bad that I'm almost comforted by the fact that it is so egregious, because it looks like something just on its face that will fail in a court of law. So there will be challenges. We already know that the governors, Kristi Noem, and a number of the other governors that are really upset about this, have announced that they're going to get together and they're going to file federal suit. And your eyebrows just went up. What do you mean? I'm looking at you across the glass.
I was, for some reason, randomly, Doug Ducey from Arizona popped in my mind. He's actually going to sue as well. Okay. I always love Trump hitting, taking shots at Ducey. It was fun. So when you say governors, I'm like, oh yeah, Ducey's doing that. Sorry.
But you think, oh, and that, you know, the graphic is up on the television right now. Well, they just took it down again. But there are a bunch of governors up there, including, again, Kristi Noem, who have come out and said, we're going to challenge this. So in terms of it being immediately implemented, I don't think that's going to happen. I think they may very well be able to get some kind of TRO, not temporary restraining order. What am I looking for? Injunction. They're going to get some kind of an injunction to stop them. And there's DeSantis. Hi. Hi, Ron. I'm waving at him on the screen. I love him. Anyway. So, but the troubling part of that is the long arm of the federal government going into private business, private enterprise. It's as scary for me as, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before that we mentioned that the federal government was going to trample on states' rights and sue. And in fact, they did that yesterday. The DOJ suing the state of Texas because of the Texas abortion law. And, you know, they raised a whole bunch of, I think, shallow, unsubstantiated claims based in the Constitution that Texas didn't have any right to do what it did, that the Texas legislature didn't have a right to do what it did. So, you know, a lot is going on. And this government, this federal government under President Biden, under Emperor Biden right now, is taking some very troubling actions and using a public health crisis as cover. And, you know, I was watching Fox yesterday, and Harmeet Dhillon, who I love, I follow her on Twitter, she made a really good point. She said, you know, we should stop calling this a pandemic. It's no longer a pandemic. It's an endemic, meaning that we've learned to live with this. We have incorporated this into our daily lives. It is no longer a natural disaster it never was a natural disaster. It was a man-made disaster. It was a Wuhan-made disaster. But it's kind of, don't call it a pandemic anymore, because it's something that we've learned to incorporate into our schedules, our daily routines. So it is troubling. And somebody said to me, they said, well, I mean, how could you attack? What kind of federal grounds or what kind of constitutional grounds could you attack this mandate, the vaccine mandate on? And honestly, I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I don't know. First thing that popped into my mind was the interstate commerce or the Commerce Clause, where by doing this, if you mandate that people get vaccinated and then you have people who are not going to get vaccinated and they're going to essentially be fired or resign, that's going to have some impact on interstate commerce and interstate travel. And it's going to negatively impact it, you know, because companies, obviously, very few of them only operate within the states within which they're actually located. I mean, so many of them depend on interstate commerce, interstate travel. So this vaccine mandate may very well impact that. That could be a constitutional basis. Again, I am not a constitutional scholar. I wish I had done better in con law when I was at Villanova, but that's the only thing I can think of at this point. We are going to take a break. And after this very brief break, we will be back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Am I the only one? Tell me I'm not. Who thinks of taking all the good we got and turning it back? Hell, I'll be damned. I think I'm turning into my old man.
Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
OSHA is a very weird way to go about this, and OSHA has original set of regulations that were passed at the beginning of OSHA decades ago. Then it has some additional regulations that were passed after, you know, notice and comment. What he's trying to do here is announce them under this very rarely used emergency provision. And the emergency provision provides that there has to be some kind of immediate, shocking, unusual threat to the workplace that's dire, and there isn't time to go through the normal process to do this. That's obviously not the case here. We've been living with COVID for 18 months now. It's not even a pandemic anymore. It's an endemic. It's something that we're living with. And Ron Klain, the chief of staff, actually retweeted a comment from somebody on Twitter saying that this was actually a workaround to get around his promise that he wouldn't do a federal vaccine mandate. They're using OSHA, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So the right. White House is acknowledging that this is really fake. Okay.
Yeah. And they're and not so even calling it a mandate. They're calling it a requirement.
Right.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. You know, Eddie, I find it particularly jarring that this mandate was announced yesterday, and it was supposedly it was mandated for our common good, that we were all supposed to pull together, that this is a way that we can protect the village. And Biden's commentary was very vitriolic and hostile toward those Americans who, for whatever reason, had not yet gotten the vaccine or were opposed to the vaccine. I mean, he almost treated them with more disdain than the American Taliban, who, I'm going to talk about that in a minute too, who are working in a professional and businesslike manner. And I just find that particularly jarring on the eve of the anniversary of 9/11, when Americans banded together to protect each other. When I think of the first responders, I'm looking at the television screen in front of me, all three of them. And at any given moment, there are tributes to the fallen of the FYPD. I'm sorry, the FN. FDNY and the NYPD, I'm thinking of them together, of the EMTs, of the frontline workers, of just they didn't think about what was in their own personal particular interest. They went and they sacrificed for the common good. That is true sacrifice for the common good. To try and frame a vaccine as something that we do to protect other people and as a patriotic act, particularly at this moment, to me is just unacceptable, wrong, unfair, really repellent. And so I am particularly angry at Joe Biden for the juxtaposition of a vaccine as something that we do to take care of other people, when, quite frankly, the science doesn't necessarily bear that out. And 9/11, when there were people who actually gave up their lives for other people. I mean, it just strikes me the wrong way. And I said a second ago that comment about the Taliban acting in a businesslike and professional manner. I heard that was a comment from the spokesperson for the NSA. And this was picked up by our favorite girl, Jen Psaki. She was asked at a press conference yesterday if there was anything off or wrong about calling the Taliban businesslike and professional. I think it was Pete Ducey that did that. Not entirely certain, but I believe that was him. Sounds like something he would have said. And she comes back and she says, well, the fact is there we need them to help us to get our people out. And it just it's just a whole mess. And I then saw video of the Taliban whipping and beating women and journalists with sticks. So I tweeted out, I said, the Taliban is whipping and beating women in a professional and businesslike manner. You just can't make these things up, Eddie. You cannot make these things up, what this administration is doing.
Moving on, can you explain a little bit more about why the White House in a statement is calling the Taliban businesslike and professional?
Well, I would note that in that statement, what we were announcing was the fact that a Qatari Airlines flight successfully landed in Qatar with American citizens, legal permanent residents, and Afghans on board who joined us in our fight over the last several years. We wanted to note that the Taliban was cooperative in facilitating the departure of these American citizens and legal permanent residents from HKIA. We promised we would get American citizens out. We promised we would get legal permanent residents out. We promised we would get our Afghan partners out. And we promised we'd press the Taliban to get them out. And that's exactly what we did.
Well, you're saying the Taliban is businesslike and professional. Their interior minister has an FBI wanted poster. He's got a $10 million bounty on his head. That's what's the business?
We are here to celebrate the return of American citizens who wanted to leave Afghanistan, of legal permanent residents, of Afghans who fought by our side, to Qatar successfully on a Qatari Airlines flight. And in order to get people out, we had to work with some members of the Taliban to press them and to work in a businesslike manner to get them out. That is what we were stating in the statement.
And in that statement, it says this is a positive first step. Towards what?
Towards getting additional people out who want to leave Afghanistan.
We promised this. We promised that. We promised, we promised, we promised. But we can't make good on our promises. The Taliban will, though. The Taliban will help us make good on our promises. Does she even recognize how much of an idiot she sounds? I'm sorry. This woman is an idiot. It's just, can I have Sarah Sanders back, please? Can I have Kayleigh McEnany, please? Can I have Dana Perino back, please? I love women. I love female press secretaries. They're fabulous. This woman is an absolute meltdown of a mess. She cannot even spin correctly. It's just, I mean, you just have to laugh.
Outside of this one church town, there's a gold dirt road to
welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. I just want to read very quickly this tweet from someone that I follow on Twitter, and I just struck me. Quote, it's from Liberty and Freedom. Quote, we're going to protect the vaccinated workers from unvaccinated co-workers. That would be a translation of vaccinated workers are not protected by their vaccination. So we should vaccinate the unvaccinated so they can also become vaccinated people who are not protected by their vaccination. Bingo. Absolutely right. The nonsense logic in President Biden's pronouncement, mandate, I mean, beyond the legality of it is just so evident in that great tweet. Well, speaking of great things, there's a guy who I really like. I follow him on Twitter, and he is a voice of reason in a vast sea of blue nonsense in the great state of New Jersey, which I absolutely love and where I've spent many, many, many happy hours of my life. And that would be the fantastic Matt Rooney from Save Journey. And Matt's a guest this morning. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Christine, it is wonderful to be with you. And it's a mutual admiration society. As much as I miss Chris when he's not around, getting to listen to you in the morning, it's fantastic. It's almost as good as a cup of coffee.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, sir. No, I love following you on Twitter because you have such great things. And you, I'm going to ask you in a minute about your most recent column, Murphy's Wind Folly, which I thought was fantastic. But I wanted to, given the fact that we're on the eve of the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and the fact that next to New York, New Jersey was the state that was most heavily impacted by that catastrophe. In fact, perhaps New Jersey might have even been more impacted because of North Jersey and the location of many of the people who worked in the Twin Towers. How are you commemorating the anniversary tomorrow? And second part of that question, do you think that the administration, that this federal administration, is doing enough to really honor the sacrifice of those who lost their lives on 9/11 20 years ago?
Oh, the Biden administration took the sacrifice of those who have died overseas and here in the United States in terrorist attacks and just thrown it right down the toilet and flushed it. And that's, you know, kind of tying together what you're talking about this morning. I mean, that's what this latest vaccine mandate is about. It's not about public health. It's about the fact that the President of the United States just directly caused the death of 13 service members in Afghanistan and countless allies of this country. Amazingly, didn't think that anybody was going to pay attention or notice. Maybe you can't blame him because certainly the press has given him plenty of passes in the past. But this time they're paying attention, maybe because they need something to report, maybe because it's so egregious, simply can't be hidden. And he needs to change the narrative. But for those of us that, as you very correctly said, Christine, have lived in this region of the world who 9/11 hurt all of us, but it really hit close to home given New Jersey's relationship with New York City. You know, it's not something that we're going to forget, and it's not something that we're going to forgive. And, you know, how do I spend the day? I'll tell you one of my favorite traditions, Ari Fleischer, who some of you may know because he's pretty prolific on Twitter, but also was a press secretary for President George W. Bush.
Right.
He shares his notes on Twitter every 9/11 because he was traveling with the president that day. And it is it's the Twitter version of that show with Kiefer Sutherland, 24, as you just track the minute-by-minute drama that was unfolding that George W. Bush had to live through. And I think for those of us who did live through it and remember that day following things on the news, I remember my dad worked in Philly at the time, and there was some concern about whether Philly was going to be the next target, and there was rumors of bridges closing, just the anxiety and the worry for your country. It brings it all back to the forefront.
That's such a great point. I was it was a Tuesday, and it was everybody remembers it being such a beautiful day, an unusually beautiful September day. And I had just gotten to my office and I'm sitting at my desk and then the news just broke of the first plane and then the second plane shortly thereafter. And there was this sense of paralysis. And then I remember going to Suburban Station in Philly, in center, and it was a ghost town. It was empty. And then just a short while later, it was filled with people getting on trains headed to New York. There were just random Philadelphians who just jumped on trains, got into their cars, figured out however they could get to New York because they wanted to help. I have never felt as proud to be an American as I did in the days after 9/11, immediately after 9/11. And yeah, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it right now.
You know why else you're emotional, Christine, if I may? Because, you know, there even in a crisis, you can find reasons for hope. And not that we didn't have profound differences between us after 9/11, but that was a rare time in recent American history where we really were able to come together and recognize that, listen, there are people overseas that want to hurt us because they don't have what we have, or maybe their leaders don't want their people to have what we have, because then those leaders wouldn't have their power and influence. So we banded together and we did what we had to do. Were there mistakes in the war? on terror? Absolutely, you know. But certainly we had a united purpose. We don't always have, at least as it's not very evident, a united purpose today. And I would argue that's by design. And the people designing that disunity are guys like Joe Biden that continue to seek out these wedge issues.
Absolutely.
To make us turn against each other, left versus right, vaccinated versus unvaccinated. That should not be the focus of Americans right now. Once you've done what you can do to protect yourself, and we've taken reasonable steps, at that point, we should be focusing on what unites us. And that's what a leader does. And Joe Biden is certainly not a leader, whether he's awake or taking one of his naps.
No, Matt, you're so right. When I watched him last night, the passion with which he criticized Americans who did not get the vaccine or who were hesitant about the vaccine, it dwarfed his anger and hostility and criticism for the Taliban. I looked at that and I said, there is just a cognitive disconnect here for me. He was almost, whenever he used to talk about the Taliban, there was this sense of, okay, they're bad, but we're done. You know, you're going to take over that country. We don't care. We're getting out. And yeah, we have people over there and we're going to do what we can to get them out. But it's so much of it seems like lip service. Yet, when he's talking to his own citizens with whom he disagrees, whether it be because they defend the life of the unborn, or they don't want to take a vaccine, or they don't believe in climate change, and I want to talk about your piece in a second, you know, whatever it is, if they disagree with him, Joe Biden doesn't like you. Joe Biden has a problem with you. Joe Biden thinks you're an idiot. Joe Biden does, now I sound like Kamala, Joe Biden, does not have anything in common with you. He is one of the most divisive figures that I have ever had, that I've ever seen in office. And, you know, the irony being everybody pointed to Donald Trump as being a divisive figure. Well, possibly so, indeed. But his successor is that on steroids.
Well, it's one thing when you're divisive because you speak tough truths, right? Mm-hmm. When you say things that are inconvenient but people need to hear. That was Donald Trump. Sometimes he didn't say things beautifully. Sometimes I wish he would have focused a little bit more on X versus Y. But that's why Donald Trump was divisive. He shook things up. Joe Biden is trying to be divisive as a strategy to turn people against one another and to constantly energize his own base. It's a cynical strategy, and I think it's going to backfire in the long run, but we're dealing with a lot of pain in the interim. So, I mean, if you're an opponent of Joe Biden, a political opponent, and you're listening to this right now, you know, don't have the discussion that they want you to have, okay? You know, the vaccine, personally, my belief, I think it works. I got the vaccine, but that's not the issue. This isn't a scientific debate. This is a very simple liberty issue. The federal government does not have the ability to mandate a vaccine for private employers. That power is nowhere, particularly in the form of an executive order. So, you know, have the discussion that needs to be had, not the one the left wants to have. Go out there and pound it every single darn day, because this is one of these slippery slope moments, folks, where if we don't take a stand, you're never going to be able to put this genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, I also have a feeling that this is yet another deflection from the catastrophe in the withdrawal from Afghanistan. This is, now we have another news cycle. Now, I'm not talking about Afghanistan. I will be in this show, but I'm talking about vaccines. I'm talking about mandates. I was talking about abortion a couple of days ago, because that was also the cycle. It's the constant deflection from really what is the most important thing that's happening right now. We lost a war. We walked out with our tail between our legs. We betrayed American allies. We betrayed allies, international allies. We betrayed our American citizens. It's just, and yet we're talking about vaccines. And you're absolutely
well,
right.
Well, someone should have told Joe Biden that the Taliban is unvaccinated. Had they done so, you might have taken it a little bit more seriously. You might have had some of these TikTok influencers and other liberal lefties signing up to go over there and forcibly vaccinate them. But yeah, look, I mean, we're joking, right? But I mean, that highlights how absolutely silly it is. I mean, that organization is directly responsible for 9/11. When you see all of the commercials and commemorances and ceremonies over the next few to several days, folks, you need to remember that the people that were responsible for this, Joe Biden just put back in charge without any questions, without any strings attached, and is angry that you're even bringing it up when he would much rather talk about abortion and vaccines and these other things. That's who leads this now.
Yeah.
And it should make you angry.
You know, I'm looking right now in the studio. We have the three television screens, and MSNBC has film of President Bush sitting in that classroom where, you know, the children, the second grade classroom, on the morning of 9/11. And I'm looking at him, and honestly, I don't think even I recognized in that moment how fortunate we were to have someone like him who had absolutely no ego. This man, disagree with George Bush if you want. I actually supported him. I thought he was a good president. Disagree with him, dislike him even. But he had a humility that was completely lacking in his predecessor, in Bill Clinton, completely lacking in President Obama. And, you know, lacking in Donald Trump, pretty clearly, and so obviously lacking in Joe Biden. And the dishonesty with Joe Biden is that he pretends to be a humble man. He pretends to be, you know, oh, Joe, pat you on the back, Joe. And he's actually a man who has a very high sense of himself. And it's a cognitive disconnect. Listen, before we go, I do want to talk about your piece at Save Jersey. .com, which I thought was really great, to bring it back to a little bit of local news with Emperor Murphy. It's called Murphy's Wind Folly. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Sure. So Phil Murphy, as many of our leftist governors do, has a fascination with renewable energy and particularly wind energy. He has this fantasy that we're going to turn the shores of New Jersey into a massive wind farm that's going to eliminate the need for fossil fuels. It's all part of what we call a master plan. You may have heard of master plan, folks, in the context of your community. Well, we have one for energy for New Jersey. And Phil Murphy says, okay, we're going to make the Garden State zero emissions by 2050. But there's a number of problems with that. The first is that, obviously, as much as I would love to be able to run my house on unicorn farts and leprechaun rainbows and all these other fantastical things, the technology does not exist. It doesn't come close to existing. Many of these technologies actually require the substantial consumption of fossil fuels to be developed and to even work. That's one of the problems. The second problem is, if you actually look at the science, and I'm specifically addressing those of you that have the cute "we believe in science" sign on your lawn, so pay attention, get out your notes. New Jersey and what we put into the atmosphere pales in comparison to what China puts in the atmosphere. China, I think it takes something like 3 or 4 days to put the same amount of nonsense into the atmosphere that it takes New Jersey a year to contribute. So you're not actually even accomplishing anything. We are already much cleaner than China and some of the world's leading polluters, okay, if you even accept that premise. So, you know, you're going to be spending somewhere around in New Jersey $525 billion for Phil Murphy's green energy agenda to get the allegedly zero emissions by 2050, and you're not even doing anything to save Mother Earth. And Christine, this is the part that I find so key, because you and I spend a lot of time, and I know Chris does too, talking about how conservatives not only need to make aggressive arguments, but also make them better.
Yep.
And I think one of the ways you get through to millennials is say, listen, if you want to drive a Flintstone car down Market Street, knock yourself out. You know, you might get pulled over, but have fun. The police in Philly, unfortunately, have much bigger things on their hands right now, so you might get away with it. But you're not actually doing anything to help. They really do think that this collective sacrifice is doing something, and it's not. So Phil Murphy's going to continue to double down on wind energy, and it saved Jersey. I appreciate you citing the article. We just go step by step and explain how wind energy actually is not profitable, doesn't really work, and it's nothing more than, you know, an expensive adventure that you, the taxpayers, are going to eventually have to subsidize for something that, you know, it sounds great at a cocktail party for the Phil Murphy limousine liberal class, but in reality, just going to make your electric bill far more expensive.
Well, you know what you also, what I think is really interesting that you note in here, you say, it takes 150 tons of coal to make a wind turbine and 2 tons of rare earth metals. And when I saw that term rare earth metals, just a ding, 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 ding went off in my head, because mm-hmm. now that we've left Afghanistan, all of those rare earth mines, they have a lot of rare earth minerals in Afghanistan. Who's taking over them right now? Who's going to have access to them? Not the United States. China.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yep. So Phil Murphy's going to eventually have to go beg Beijing, I guess, if they keep going the way they're going.
There
to
you
build
go.
His stupid wind turbines.
There
yep.
you go. There you go. It's unbelievable. Well, Matt, you're fabulous. You are saving Jersey. And the next time that you're on with me or with Chris, I want you to talk about Jack Cittarelli. I had our beloved friend Dan Cerucci on the other day talking about that. And
my buddy.
Hopefully. Oh, he's amazing. We love him dearly. But hopefully he's very optimistic about Jack. So the next time you're on, I want to talk about that. Matt, you're fabulous. Have a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me, my friend. Great listening to you.
You're the best. That was the great Matt Rooney from Save Jersey. And this is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. We'll be right back.
America. America. Make God thy gold refine.
Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. Everything you need is waiting for you at 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flower sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. In the next hour, in the next segment, I'm going to be interviewing someone who I am so happy that we were able to have come on the show, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Myers, and he's going to talk to us about some activities that he's been involved in that remind me of what happened on Flight 93, United Flight 93, which was when Americans came together at an emergency moment and without any planning, without any hesitation, tried to protect other Americans. It's an amazing story, and we'll talk about it in the segment coming up.
This is WNTP Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for doing what you're doing in the media.
Good morning, Chris. I listen to you every morning. Thanks.
Hey, Mr. Segal, may he whose father gave us life keep you well and safe.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer. I am particularly gratified to be able to invite this next guest onto the program. Those of you who have been listening to me over the past few days know that in my regular life, I'm an immigration attorney, and some of the work that I've been doing recently is with respect to trying to help Afghan citizens and green card holders in the United States and those who were our allies who worked with the military or their family members to get out of Afghanistan and to be able to come to the United States. It's for this reason that I am so grateful to be able to speak with our next guest, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Myers, a retired Marine intelligence officer whose last position was as an intelligence officer under the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley. Colonel Myers was the subject of a piece written by Selena Zito in the Washington Examiner, which discussed his efforts and those of two other retired military to rescue trapped Americans and allies behind enemy lines, and the lengths that he and his colleagues went to save these threatened individuals who were in jeopardy. And so I am so honored to welcome into the program Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Myers. Colonel Myers, thank you so much for being willing to speak with me this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
I read the article that was written by Selena Zito, and I really read it with a lump in my throat because with my own personal experience, knowing how difficult it is from my end, which is an administrative end, trying to get humanitarian parole, trying to figure out a way to get these family members into the United States, I can only imagine how difficult it has been for you and for your colleagues to do what the U.S. government has not either been willing to or capable of doing, and that is keeping its promise of making sure that American citizens, green card holders, and most importantly, allies, people who place themselves in jeopardy by working with the United States, with the military, with the government, getting them out. Can you talk to us about your efforts? What triggered this initiative to really mobilize and try and get these people out?
Okay, thank you. Well, in our case in particular, I'm a retired Marine and I'm working with two other former Marines. And it started just as a lot of people who are also involved will tell you, and that is I started getting flooded with emails from around the world with Marines looking for help with their interpreters. And it just so happened that I was connected with the Marines who were conducting the mission from CENTCOM and down in Kabul, as were my teammates. So we started to serve as a conduit, getting those names of interpreters and allies to the Marines so that they would know who to try to get out, because they had no information going in and the State Department wasn't providing any. And as we worked over the weeks, of course, that morphed into us trying to get anybody, American citizens, other allies that people were contacting us about. And pretty much our success rate plummeted once the U.S. Pulled out, but the efforts are ongoing with the airplanes that I'm sure everybody's heard about up north. And we literally have hundreds and hundreds, if not over 1,000 of these allies that we're still trying to get out. And I wish I could say that it was going better than it is.
Yeah, I know better than most the situation that is happening over there. It's almost impossible to get people out. I mentioned earlier in this show that I was struck by Jen Psaki basically acknowledging or describing the activities of the Taliban as businesslike and professional. How do you feel as a retired Marine that we have our government actually engaging, dealing with the Taliban and almost trying to deal with them as equal partners in getting people out of the country? I mean, because the Taliban have essentially stated that the only people that are going to be leaving, if they leave, are American citizens and or citizens of foreign countries, but no one who has Afghan citizenship. And that would cover most of the interpreters and the allies that assisted us with the military over the past 20 years.
Well, the State Department really put themselves in this position, didn't they, by not completing the job before taking the last troops out. And in terms of the statements that they're professional and in their business dealings, I'm sure they're just trying to ensure that the Taliban doesn't go out of control and start executing American citizens. However, I know for a fact I had some American citizens up in that position that's been widely publicized on the news waiting for evacuation, and within the last 48 hours they've fled. One, because she just grew tired. She tried for a week in Kabul and then 10 days with us, and so she fled. And then the other one is an American toddler with an Afghan mother who tried for a week. The baby is injured, slashed her foot open on some razor wire after being pushed into a sewage canal by the Taliban. And then the Taliban showed up 2 days ago and executed her brothers. So they're not really being very businesslike and professional, but this information is not getting out to the public.
It's really troubling, Colonel Myers, that this they're trying to pivot away from Afghanistan. It doesn't seem to be that the White House doesn't seem to be focusing on what's going on there right now. Now it's mandates on vaccines and the Texas abortion law, when the major and only important news story right now should be, did we get everyone out? Did we leave anyone behind? And you know better than anyone that we did leave people behind, and that those people are, I mean, the doors are closing. The doors, if they're not closing, if they haven't already closed, it's just, do you have any idea as to whether or not how many people are left in Afghanistan who want to leave? We've been given this bill of goods, this idea that there are Americans that want to stay, that don't want to leave because of family ties or what have you. But do you guys have any kind of clear estimate as to how many people actually still remain behind enemy lines?
I don't know that we have a crystal clear estimate. I know that I'm currently staring at a spreadsheet that has at least 30 in the area of Kabul who desperately want to get out. And I know the State Department is trying a last-minute effort to look like they're cleaning things up by having these flights out of Kabul. There was one yesterday, Qatari Airways. It looked like either an Airbus or a 777 that can hold more than 300 people, and it had 113 people on it, of which 20 were citizens. And none of the American citizens that I have, my teams and other teams are currently tracking, were sent an invite to get on that airplane. So it's not going as well as they're saying. That, to me, was just a token to throw out to try to save some grace, but it's not going well currently.
There were leaked emails or leaked communications between the State Department and some private organizations. I don't know if your organization was involved in this, basically indicating that they would not provide clearance, that they would not allow for any kind of clearance for exits on private transport. Is that accurate? Or is that being misrepresented in the media? Is it true that the State Department essentially shut down private efforts to evacuate these individuals?
It is 100% true. So my group is somewhat independent, as I said, three former Marines, but we are working with other groups such as the Pineapple Express group and other veterans groups. And amongst us, we are all responsible for those airplanes up north. And in the case of the two airplanes that I'm intimately involved with and our evacuees, in the first 36 or 48 hours that we had them up there, I had received clearance from CENTCOM to fly our planes, and then it was shut down by the State Department. And after that 36 or 48-hour window, the Taliban showed up and arrived in the control tower itself and started making their demands. So I can absolutely confirm that.
And why, if you know, would the government actually provide a manifest of names of individuals who were intending to leave to the Taliban? That seems, even if you put it in the best light that they were trying to expedite the exit of these individuals, it seems like it's putting a target on the head of the people who are on that list. Is there any legitimate reason for the State Department to have given that information to the Taliban under the guise of, you know, trying to facilitate or expedite their exit, to be identified so they could get on planes?
No, because the Taliban has made it clear that they're not going to allow anybody to fly that doesn't have a blue passport. And they've even gone so far as to say that the Blue Passport must have a visa for Afghanistan, because they know that most of the Afghan Americans have had those passports issued to them since they've lived in Afghanistan. So they're definitely playing games. And that's strike three against us in terms of providing lists of people. And I understand that they provided the manifests that were put together for these airplanes, which, again, is just unbelievable. And what it really says to me is that it really demonstrates the political naivete of you know, the people in the national security apparatus, that it's obvious you couldn't be a qualified national security expert and make a decision like that. So that has to be the reason that this is happening.
You were an intelligence officer, and you worked under General Milley. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on General Milley's conduct in this, but you mentioned the fact that no seasoned intelligence staff or officer would do this, would work this way. Are there individuals who were working under the Trump administration who are still in positions of authority under the Biden administration, sort of like a carryover from the last administration? Or are these all new appointees, all new individuals who are in office right now and who are working?
There was definitely a cleaning house. Of course, the uniformed people are protected by their positions through the military. But in terms of the political side and the appointees and the Pentagon, it was a full cleaning of house, and all these appointees are Biden appointees. And I know from my own experience and my own information that at least a couple of them I know can identify personally are not qualified for the positions they're in. And they're in extremely high-level decision-making positions. And they were granted these positions because of campaign activities or bundling donations.
It's just so troubling. Colonel Myers, I wanted to, before I let you go, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about your new book, American to the Core, C-O-R-P-S, American to the Core. What's it about? Is it a memoir, or can you give us an idea as to what you were writing about?
It's a memoir that covers my 28 years as a Marine Corps intelligence officer. It just so happens that I was involved in a lot of high-profile missions just by luck of the draw and timing, such as I was the officer in charge of planning the response to the Benghazi attacks in terms of reinforcing the U.S. Embassy there, and then also the Snowden investigation for the Marine Corps, as well as the rescue of Captain O'Grady in the 90s. So I just happened to have a lot of interesting information to get out to the public, some behind-the-scenes information, and so I just cobbled that all together in this book.
It sounds wonderful. I'm going to make sure that I get a copy of that. And I just want to, personally, I just want to thank you so much for what you've done, for your service to the country, but particularly your service after retirement. What you are doing now is just so inspiring. It reminds me of what, and I know this may seem like a slight disconnect, but on the eve of the anniversary of 9/11, it reminds me of what the civilians on Flight 93 did, and that is Americans getting together, using their ingenuity in the face of incredible odds, and trying to do something to help others. And I think, knowing myself, as I said, I'm doing this work, and I understand the difficulties that you in particular are up against, dealing cross country with this. I want to thank you. I know on behalf of the audience, but on behalf of all Americans, for really representing the best of what we are and who we are. And Godspeed and great good luck to you in your mission. I hope that you're able to get the rest of the individuals that are on your list out of the country and to safety. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I want to remind you, it's a team effort. There's a lot of us. So I'll pass that information on. And thank you very much.
God bless. That was Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan P. Myers. His new book, a memoir, American to the Core, is out now, and I would strongly suggest that you go out and get a copy. This is Christine Flowers, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. We'll be right back.
And we've drawn the line.
More of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaul on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. In the 7:30 segment, we've got a longtime friend of Chris DeGaulle and the show, and that would be Guy Ciarocchi, president and CEO of the Chester County Chamber of Commerce, Chamber of Business and Industry. I'm looking forward to talking to Guy. I have relatives whose last name are Ciarocchi, so I'm wondering if we're related at some point. It's possible.
It may have been Americanized a little bit in some way because it's Ciarocchi.
Ciarocchi. Ciarocchi. Well, if I'm going to say it in the Italian way, it's Ciarocchi. Just like your name is Chiazzo.
Right. And actually, if you go all the way back, it's actually like Chiazzo.
Chiazzo.
I'm an American, man. Just put the Y where that I is and just call me Chiazzo.
Like, I'm totally American, dude.
American, dude.
Totally. My mother's maiden name was Fusco. Easy to say, F-U-S-C-O. Yeah. But I have a feeling a couple generations back, it was something like Montefusco. And then they came through Ellis Island and the guys looked at that and said, what the heck is this? Boom. You're either Monte or Fusco. Choose. And they chose Fusco.
And they always lose letters somewhere along the way, too. It's amazing to think people making that journey.
I saw a pizzeria. First of all, Giuseppe's a very common Italian name, right?
Sure.
And it's spelled Giuseppe. Unfortunately for Americans, when we see a G, we're not used to seeing an I after it. We're used to seeing a U after it,
yep.
Like guard, like, you know, whatever, guide. So I saw this pizzeria and it said Giuseppe's Pizza. Giuseppe. And I'm looking at it. It's a G-U-I-S-E-P-P-E. So I went in to the pizzeria and I asked to speak with Giuseppe. and they said, no, Giuseppe is not here. I said, is his name Giuseppe or Giuseppe? He goes, oh, it's a Giuseppe. He was an American, a guy who did the design. And it cost too much to change.
I would not have noticed that. That is good Italian knowledge there, Christine.
It's being a very anal language speaker.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, I teached languages. Did you hear me say that?
But that's so, I love it. That's so Italian that they just never fixed the sign. That's amazing.
You know, it costs a lot of money. We just keep it like that. You know, nobody, I know he wanted to say, lady, what's your problem? Why you notice this? He's a name of Giuseppe. Just leave it like that. Oh, boy. Anyway, so as I said, in the next... I wonder if Guy's related to Pat Ciarocchi, remember, from KYW?
Oh, gosh, I don't.
No, I know.
I only listen for the school closing.
It's all stream of I still remember my school closing number, too. Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Thank you, Christine.
Okay, guys, I've been up since 4 o'clock every day this week, all right?
All's good in the hood. Here we go. But our guest is on the line.
Okay. Now, how does he pronounce his last name?
All right, I'm telling it's Ciarocchi.
Ciarocchi.
Yes.
Ciarocchi. So without further ado, I'm going to welcome in somebody that I might be distantly related to, although I'm not entirely certain. That would be Guy Ciarocchi from the Chester County. He's the CEO of the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry. Hey, Guy Ciarocchi, how are you?
Very good, my distant cousin. How are you?
I actually do. I have my cousin Connie and my cousin Johnny. They pronounce their name Ciarocchi.
Yes.
But it's not really a common name. What part of Italy does your family come from?
We come from the East Coast, right in the Marche district, just above Abruzzi, in a town called Ascoli Piceno.
There you go. Okay, so my mom's side of the family was from a town in Chieti, in Abruzzo, tiny little town called Guardia Grel. But they also had Ascolani. They had relatives who lived up in Ascoli Piceno. It's beautiful. I've been there. Have you ever been there?
Yes. I was a very long time ago. Let's just say Ronald Reagan was president at the time.
He was the first president I ever voted for. I was very proud to be able to vote for. And I was a registered Democrat back then. But even then, I must have had a sense of things being wrong with the party because I voted for the Republican. Anyway, it's really good to talk to you. I listen to you all the time when you're on with Chris, and you have such great things to say. And you're so optimistic, and that's why I found your recent piece at Broad and Liberty really interesting. Because you followed through that thread of optimism. You open up the piece. It's basically Pennsylvania, a rising or setting sun. And I know what that was in reference to, but you tell us, what was that title in reference to?
Sure. Well, on this show, we're still allowed to talk about American history and the founding fathers, so I feel safe doing this. But down in Philadelphia, it is reported that at the conclusion of the Constitutional Convention, George Washington was sitting in a chair presiding over the discussion, and was sitting in a chair that has this artist, had handcrafted in a picture of a sun. And the debate, and one of the stories during the discussion was, what about this sun? Is it a rising or setting sun? And Benjamin Franklin is to have remarked that it was indeed, now with their work finished, with the Constitution in place, it was a rising sun, and that America was now a rising sun, and that any concern about whether the new nation could take hold and grow, that those fears were behind them, and America would be a rising sun. And I thought, as we looked out, particularly over the last 2 years, with all of the challenges we've gone through, as we look to the future, has America's best days, has Pennsylvania's best days gone behind us, or is it still possible the sun may be rising? And I would say, despite all the concern we've had over the last 2 years, there's every reason to believe that with the right leadership and the right plan, the Pennsylvania sun could be rising.
I love that. And I think I agree with you. I'm by nature, I'm an optimistic person. A lot of what's happened over the administration of Tom Wolf has disappointed me, depressed me, in some cases nauseated me. But I do think that we are resilient people, we Pennsylvanians. And I agree with your assessment that even though some bad things have happened in the past, particularly in the past couple of years with the pandemic, that we're the type of people that are going to be able to pull out of this. And I found your piece really interesting. By the way, it's at Broad and Liberty. Great, great website. Guy's a regular columnist there. And this piece it opens up with the phrase managing decline. What does that mean, managing decline? That sounds pretty depressing.
It is depressing. It's a phrase that, for those of us who have been working in public policy, particularly in Harrisburg, it's a discussion you hear a lot behind closed doors. It usually regards how do we get through each state budget, because almost every year, except for some rare exceptions, when the legislators try to pass a budget, their approach is managed decline, meaning that resources are dwindling, our population is getting older and poorer, and how are we ever going to get through the next year? And it struck me, because as I've been calling my counterparts around the state and other chambers, there's a chamber executive in Erie who is a professional in economic development and reforming and turning around local communities. And the long story short is, he's in Erie, and he had worked in six other states. And he said to me, Guy, I've been in six other states. Nobody else talks about managed decline but Pennsylvania. And when I first came to Erie, he said, Guy, in the first 30 days, I was told about managed decline six times. And as he shared, and I wrote, it's not only about a negative outlook of the economy, but it's a negative outlook on life. It's a depressing one. It's where you don't take risks, where you don't look hopefully. As I said, it's like the widow who looks at her bank account shrinking every day, and sort of each day she wakes up is sort of both happy and depressed because she's not sure how she's going to make it much longer on these dwindling resources. So I'm suggesting that we get rid of that from Pennsylvania's outlook, that we stop thinking about how do we just hang on, how do we pinch pennies, and instead think about what if Pennsylvania's economy was actually growing and we didn't have to worry about limiting resources in a shrinking population that's getting older and poorer, and instead we were a destination for growth and opportunity, and how that would change our not only our bank accounts, but our outlook and our approach and our willingness to be bold.
I think you make a great point there in that, yeah, demographically, we do have an aging Commonwealth, an aging state. But you also point out the fact that we have some of the best universities in the country, not to mention we have a lot of universities, both private and public. And I guess the key to it would be to keep the people, the young people that come here, that go to school here and may not be from Pennsylvania, but who come here, and keep them here, or keep the young native-grown talent from going elsewhere, as opposed to just sort of throwing up our hands and saying the inevitable is going to happen. We're just all going to, you know, die away. Because I remember I went to a college that attracted people from all over the country. I mean, the very few Pennsylvanians actually attended Bryn Mawr. Most of them were from out of state. A lot of them decided to stay in Pennsylvania. This is years ago. But I think you have the right idea that we need to start looking to attract people as opposed to just sort of accepting the inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, you make an excellent point, and we really do. And you know, as you get into campaigns and politics, you're always concerned that there's hyperbole and exaggeration and all that sort of stuff taking over. But as I went through in the column, the reality is even a neutral observer would think that we have the assets. I mean, the reality is when I talk to other chamber executives, not only across the state but around the nation, almost any state would trade with us with where we are, because the reality is this. When you look at what Pennsylvania has, Pennsylvania is a microcosm of the nation. Almost every sector of the national economy is in Pennsylvania, and in many cases, we have more resources. We're one of the top agriculture producers. We have more universities per capita than all but two states. We have some of the best hospitals in the world, not just in the nation, in the world. We forget and take for granted that people come to CHOP and Penn and UPMC out in Pittsburgh from around the world. We have biopharma companies doing research and startups in Chester County, Lehigh Valley, Pittsburgh, all across the nation, all across the state. In addition, we sometimes forget we are the Keystone State, which puts us in a position to trade with Canada, South America, Europe, and most of the United States. Most trade comes through us, particularly on truck and rail. And we're sitting on more energy than almost any nation on the planet. If we can figure a way to safely, securely get that to market, we can heat our homes, run our businesses, and manage our schools and save millions of dollars and have breakthrough technology and cleaner air. So energy, agriculture, science, medicine, universities, trade. The sad joke I wrote in the column, it's that you would believe that Tom Wolf and the folks in Harrisburg actually were trying to fail. Because if you're given all those assets, plus tens of thousands of small businesses, it's almost impossible to fail, yet we've managed to be in the bottom 10 states instead of the top 10, which is where we belong.
You're absolutely right. It's as if they have a death wish for themselves. And I would add to your list of the marvels that we have in this Commonwealth, we also have a very strong, and I'm sort of like doing a little bit of self-promotion here, but we have a very strong immigrant community. You talked about agriculture. Many of the people working in agriculture in Pennsylvania, out in your end of the world, in Chester County, are immigrants, have immigrated from other countries. They want to be here in the United States. Many of them are extremely hard workers. And I think that if you consider that's going to make a younger population, that's also because immigrants have a tendency to reproduce at higher rates than the native born. So we have, I mean, I really think that we have a mother load of great resources and opportunities and just natural resources in this magnificent Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm a native of Baltimore. I was born in Baltimore, and 2 months later, my family returned home to their native Philadelphia. And I cannot be more grateful that they did that, because I would not want to have grown up in any other state other than the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We need more boosters. We need people like you. We need people out there talking up the state instead of doing what this administration has done, doom and gloom, and we're all sick, and let's wrap ourselves in masks, let's mummify ourselves, let's hide in our homes, and let's just wait for the day that we die. I just can't wait until this administration is gone.
Yeah, no, it has been. I mean, the reality is, and, you know, I've written about it, talked about it with Chris and others before. I mean, the reality is, it is not only that we're missing an opportunity on the assets, but there's been no leadership. I mean, the governor has either been absent or issuing these edicts. It's sort of like Oz, you know, like an evil Oz. I mean, he either is absent or he issues edicts and you don't really see him. I'm still waiting 19 months into this to hear an uplifting talk, to see him visit a Little League game, to see him go to a mall, to see him visit a farm and encourage people to be safe and get back to work and to do things and to tell us our best days are ahead. And again, not in a syrupy movie sort of, you know, don't worry, it'll be fine. But I mean, my goodness, I mean, as we come up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, for those of us who are old enough to remember, you know, not necessarily Rudy Giuliani 2020 or 2021, but remember Rudy Giuliani standing there in the dust of the towers and saying, we will come back. It was Rudy Giuliani, even before President Bush, it was Rudy Giuliani who stood there in the midst of that horror and said, we will rebuild New York City. We will be back. And you didn't doubt it when you heard it in his voice. And you've been waiting for that moment for Tom Wolf to stand with parents, to stand with factory workers, to stand with folks and say, we can do better. We will be back. And that's never come. So it may be time for him to leave, and it's time for us to look for someone else to chart us on a path forward and to get out of doom and gloom and to say, we do have these assets. We do want our Pennsylvania students to stay here. We do want to attract people. You know, we talk about all the time, you know, kids go, they leave us, they go to North Carolina or Florida or Texas, and now in the economic development circles, we talk about Arizona and Utah. I mean, one of the stories is how Utah is booming and attracting the best and brightest. And instead of being resigned to that, you know, I say rhetorically, but also sincerely, imagine a day 5 or 10 years from now where high school graduates from Texas say, I want to be in Pennsylvania because that's where the action is. That's the new energy industry of the nation. It's the new biopharmaceutical engine of the nation. That's what we should be thinking about. Instead of being resigned to despair, we should be thinking about what if this was the place everyone wanted to come to and how that would change our outlook and how it would change our quality of life.
You're right. We need the inspiration from the top. We need a different messaging because people respond to that. It's not just appearances. People really do respond to optimism, and they take their lead from the people who are in positions of authority. And Tom Wolf is simply not the person for this moment. Now, obviously, we're talking about a man who's going to be leaving anyway. He's a lame duck. But we need someone with an inspirational, and also someone who's not divisive, someone who is willing to inspire on both sides of the aisle, regardless of your political party. And, you know, somebody who can actually transcend, as Rudy Giuliani did, and as I think George Bush did, somebody who can transcend difficulty and just look and see people and take them at the place that they are. So I'm looking forward to just having someone new in the White House, and the White House in Harris, in the White House too, believe me.
But yeah,
in Harrisburg, yeah. Yeah, I know, believe me, cousin guy, I do. I'd like that in the White House as well. But well, you know, it's great. I would tell everyone in the listening audience to read your piece. It has a lot of good information. It's really inspiring about what we really do have in Pennsylvania. We're rich in so many ways. We just need to convince ourselves of that. You know, I live in Philadelphia, and Philadelphians have this traditional chip on their shoulders. And even though the rest of the country can look at Philadelphia, even though it is the murder capital of the city, you know, the world, but let's not talk about that right now. There are so many good things about Philadelphia. People like Travel Magazine and Condé Nast, all of this, they can look and they can say, oh, wow, it's great. And you ask the average Philadelphian and they go, oh, we stink. We need to get out of ourselves a little bit and have a little bit more, optimism. Anyway, Guy, it was wonderful to talk to you. And I hope you have a wonderful weekend, a sobering weekend, given the commemoration, but also one that I know you and I will both use to appreciate the fact that we're here in this wonderful country. That was Guy Shadoki.
Thank you so much. I will talk to you again soon, my cousin. Take care. Bye-bye.
Ciao. That was Guy Shadoki from the Chester County Chamber of Business and Industry. He was a CEO. He is the CEO. And this is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. We'll be right back. Just down the street, I want to marry her. She wants to marry me. Money's kind of tight, but love don't care. Me and this truck been everywhere. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. In the 8 o'clock segment, I'm very happy. I'm going to be able to speak with Clarice Schillinger. And she is the founder of Back to School PA, which is a PAC that was created to essentially support school board candidates who are in favor of keeping schools open. And that would be countering this move for virtual schooling, countering the move to basically keep children isolated in their homes, keeping schools open to counteract a lot of the mandates also in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And as we recently saw, Governor Wolf has decided to completely do a 180, a flip, which is not surprising for Governor Wolf, and mandate masks for children in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in schools K through 12. You will also remember that there was a movement earlier this year, and it was a referendum that severely limited the executive powers, the emergency powers of the governor during the pandemic. You know, that he couldn't just randomly order a shutdown or limitation on business hours or, again, mask mandates. However, you know, not to be dissuaded, not to be discouraged, Tom Wolf went back to a law from, what is it, 1955, Eddie?
I believe so, yeah.
1955.
Yeah.
And that law allegedly supports his argument that, yes, I can mandate still, even in spite of this referendum limiting my powers, I can still mandate these masks. It's a major stretch. But before I speak to Clarice, I do want to mention something, and it's actually quite good news. It's proactivity on the part of parents and concerned citizens. On Wednesday of this week, the Tredyffrin Easttown School District was sued by parents and or guardians. And the basis of that lawsuit was that the mask mandates that were put forth by the acting secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Health are unlawful. The plaintiffs are represented by a very well-known firm in the city of Philadelphia, Obermeyer, Redmond, Maxwell, and Hipple. And the case itself is, the caption of it is Geerlings versus Tredyffrin Easttown Township School District. I wanted to put that out there. I want to give you their email address, because if this particular case is successful, that will be a precedent for other school districts in this area. That will be a template. That will be a model for other school districts and parents in other school districts to follow, to be able to rein in these rogue school boards who are continuously putting forth mandates that don't serve the children, students, don't serve parents, don't serve teachers, and don't serve the community. If you're interested and you want to get in touch with the people who are spearheading the lawsuits, you can write to freedompa@protonmail.com. That email is freedompa@protonmail.com. It really is a worthwhile initiative, and it's a sign that people are waking up and they're using the legal system to their benefit. So good luck to the parents in Tredyffrin Easttown. My fingers are crossed for them, and I'm hoping for the best for that lawsuit and for future lawsuits. We are going to take a break, and on the other side, we're going to continue. This is Christine Flowers, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP Philadelphia. Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Download our free mobile app at 990theanswer.com. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Your common sense is really keeping me sane. Thank you.
I start in the morning with Chris, and then I go all the way through the day until I get out of my car when I come home.
Good morning, man. Love your show.
There's nothing, not a single thing we're unable to do if we do it together. So let's stay together. God bless you all. And all those who continue to serve on the front lines of this pandemic. And may God protect our troops. Get vaccinated.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Hey, Eddie. Let's stay together. It's like Reverend Al Green. I'm so in love with you. You got that clip? No. You have that music?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whatever you want me to.
It's got a cue up. That's
all I thought of when he said, let's stay together. And then he whispered, get vaccinated. It's like, baby. Go, do it. And I just expected like the music from Shaft to come on. Hey, do it. Vaccinate yourself for me.
We'll bump out with that.
Vaccinate my love. Oh my Lord. Craziness. Anyway, speaking of vaccination, speaking of masking, speaking of mandates, as I said, this is Christine Flowers, by the way, sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Emperor Tom Wolf, Governor Tom Wolf, has decided to circumvent the limitations placed on him by the referendum back in May, the referendum in the spring, which limited his emergency powers. And as I said right before the break, he's gone back to some archaic law from 1955. I mean, it's so old. It was around before I was born. And apparently he's sunk his teeth into that one and somehow come up with authority to be able to mandate masks yet again. It's like we're on this roller coaster, up and down. Now we're down again. And for that reason, I'm really glad to have my next guest on. It's Clarice Schillinger. And Clarice is a founder of the Pack Back to School PA. And this is a wonderful organization, that a grassroots organization that gathers funding for school board candidates, those candidates who would be obviously individuals who are interested in keeping schools open and functioning and trying to combat the trend of virtual, the continued, almost prolonged trend of virtual schooling or hybrid schooling, which really is damaging to children. And I am really happy to welcome Clarice because I want to ask her how the PAC and how her organization is planning to confront this new mask mandate and other initiatives. So without further ado, hi, Clarice. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being on this morning.
Yes, Christine, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to share everything that we're doing across the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I am. I'm too. I'm really interested, particularly since this is a statewide effort. I mean, we in southeastern Pennsylvania sometimes don't have as much information as we should about what's going on cross state. And, you know, the state is a hybrid. It's not, you know, when you're in southeastern Pennsylvania, you have a very skewed view of what's going on, let's say, in central PA or northeastern PA or north central PA or western PA. So first of all, can you give us some background on back to school PA and what was the genesis of it? And, you know, what was the reason that you formed the organization?
Sure. Yeah. So first and foremost, and my most important job is I'm a mom. And I saw my children struggling with a year and a half of virtual learning. They did go back to school 1 month exactly to the day before the primary election for school board. I'll let you and your listeners come up with that conclusion. But I thought it was very ironic that the first time they stepped foot back into school was 1 month before, you know, a primary election happens.
Yeah, no coincidence there.
Yeah, what a coincidence, right? So,
right.
You know, with that, I really saw how political these school closings had gotten. So back in January, I had started a political action committee in the Southeast Pennsylvania and ran 94 candidates, and we had 98% success in the primary.
That's amazing. Fantastic.
I didn't sleep much.
I was going to say, but 98%. Wow. You're a kingmaker, yes. Clarice. That's pretty amazing.
Thank you. So with that, I teamed up with a fellow parent, Paul Martino, and he said, Clarice, we're not done. And I said, okay, what's your idea? And he said, I'll give you $500,000, go out to the state of Pennsylvania and find people like you who are running school board candidates who are not owned by the teachers union, who will keep our schools open, who will ask questions to the administration. Go find those people and give them funding. So what we've done is we've actually handed out $350,000. There are $10,000 check increments to slates of candidates throughout the state to their political action committees. For funding to win the general election. We also provide them with resources and connections and really trying to, you know, I'll be honest with you. We are just doing what the PSEA, AFT, Teachers Union has done for decades.
Yeah, no, I think it's fantastic. You have taken a page from their playbook and you're playing it, you're running it down the field even better than they have. I think this is exactly what you needed to do. Instead of, you know, sort of tearing our hair out and sitting on our hands and saying, oh, woe is us. You said, okay, all right, I can do this. They can do it. I can do this. And you're having unprecedented success with this. You started out in southeastern Pennsylvania, correct?
Yes.
Are you originally from this area?
Yes. I'm actually in Horsham, so Montgomery Township or Montgomery County.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I know Horsham well. It's a beautiful area. So what other parts of the state have you been involved in school board elections?
So currently we're in 35 different school board races, and they are throughout the state. We just got back last week from Allegheny County. That's Pittsburgh area, where we ended up supporting 6 slates of candidates. We gave them $60,000. And I will note, like, as you mentioned, it's hard to see what, you know, the whole state is doing. But believe it or not, Pittsburgh School District, their public school system is still not open.
Are you kidding me? 2 years later?
No. they are still not open.
At any level, there's not even hybrid learning?
Virtual learning.
Oh, outrageous. Outrageous.
So it is, right? So a lot of parents say, well, schools are back, you know, in the Southeast. And I will note, schools are back in the Southeast. But I think that it's important to understand these children are going into these schools. They're masked up, you know, they are trying very hard to mandate the vaccine. And what's happening to these children is if they're in contact with someone or exposed, as they call it, is they have to sit 2 weeks at home.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're in school, but they're going back and forth, right? So if they're exposed, say they go into school, they're exposed, they sit home for 2 weeks, they go back in, they're exposed again, they sit home for another 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, there's no consistency here. And I don't have any children, but I have a nephew, mm-hmm. and he's going into the seventh grade. And it is really difficult, especially for middle school children. They need that
yes.
consistency. You're constantly, I mean, you're a mother, you know. If particularly boys, I think, they need that mm-hmm. hands-on contact. It's so frustrating. And the ideological arrogance of some members of school boards. Believe me, I have never, ever in my life before this year or before late last year watched YouTube on live or streaming meetings of school boards, of local school boards. But I do it all the time now because that's where the change is happening. And that's where, and you figured that out. This is where local is political. Local is where the power structures really are generated. And, you know, that's the sort of the petri dish of the experiment. And it is amazing to see now that school boards are being observed by parents and by other individuals, how they're reacting so negatively to this. And they're not acting, it seems, in a collaborative way. Am I jumping to conclusions on that, or have you seen that as well?
No. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, really, because, I mean, our parents have had microphones ripped out of their hands. They've been screamed at. They've been escorted out. I mean, it is so terrible. I mean, the public comment session has gone from 5 minutes to 3 minutes to 2 minutes. So now you have these parents who wait all month to get their little piece in and say, please consider this. Please consider my child. They're doing homework for a month, right, of what they're going to say in the 2 minutes that they have allotted. They're timing themselves at home before they're going in the meetings to make sure they don't get cut off.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've ever seen tyranny, this is it, right?
Absolutely.
And this is, it is so it's hurtful to me and to these parents and the thousands of people that we have behind us is because our children are stuck in the middle of it. And one of my little sayings that I tell a lot of people is, I think that we can all agree there's one person in the whole world that you just never want to upset. And that's your mom.
That's exactly right. Remember Sarah Palin? She talked about the hockey moms as what's the difference yep. between a hockey mom and a pit bull lipstick. But it's true. You know, mama grizzlies, mm-hmm. they will take care. They will take a bullet for their children.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the fact that and I love the women who are involved in this. As you said, there is just this. They really are. You guys are warrior chicks. And I love the initiative and the passion. Right before you came on, I mentioned on air a lawsuit that was just filed on Wednesday against mm-hmm. Tredyffrin East Town School District by parents and guardians. It's Geerlings. The site is Geerlings versus Tredyffrin East Town Township, and it's a challenge to the mask mandates. And mm-hmm. it's really interesting because if this is successful, I mean, they're going to court. They're doing sort of they're doing what you did only in the courts. They're taking it to the courts. And basically, if they're successful, then that can be applied to other school districts in southeastern PA and, again, northeastern PA and central Pennsylvania. Do you notice any difference between southeastern Pennsylvania about the boards and the races in southeastern Pennsylvania, with the, you know, the exception of Pittsburgh that you already mentioned, and other areas of the state? Is southeastern Pennsylvania representative of what's going on in other areas of the state, or is it an anomaly?
Southeast Pennsylvania, you know, we're really, really purple. So I think that our fight is a little bit harder than some other areas of the state of PA. But, I mean, we're in Erie, we're in Allegheny, we're in, you know, we have seen even like Dauphin County, Harrisburg area, we're there too. So, you know, I think that what we are is the front runners, right? Like, this is what we're doing, and we're sharing it with the state, and we're saying, this is what you need to be doing. And I will mention that Tradition East Town is one of the school districts, the slates, who we are supporting.
Great. Great.
Right. So, and I wish them the most success. But what I will say with that, and I'm going to make you and Eddie chuckle a little bit, but it's actually the 1929 Act that Governor Wolf put into place.
Oh my gosh, so, it's not even 1955. My grandmother my mother wasn't born yet. Oh my God.
Right. I mean, 1929. So, you know, when he put that mask mandate in place, I think that this is super important for everyone to understand. 3 weeks before he put that in place, he was quoted multiple times that he would not put a mask mandate in place. Then 3 weeks later, he says, well, I'm enacting the 1929 Health and Disease Crisis through the Department of Health. Okay? So what he knew all along that he was going to do this, and he said, not enough school districts did what I wanted. Not enough counties did what I wanted. So really, in fact, none of you had a choice. I always was going to enact this. But on the way of back to school, PA, like our stance on this,
yeah,
is if he did that in 3 weeks, what do schools look like open or closed in 3 weeks? What do schools look like after these school board elections? My fear is we will see them shut down.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's this sense of It's just I don't want to say lawlessness. It's almost he has a mandate. He has this sense. He does not want to abandon this idea, this sense that he gets to make the rules in the Commonwealth. He gets to decide what's in our best health. I mean, this is completely off track, Clarice, but I just find it incredibly ironic that this governor, who is so rabidly in favor of abortion rights, you know, he was a clinic escort. He talks about the health of children. He demands that they be mummified in masks. He is, you know, on the point of demanding vaccinations. He cares about the health of children. And yet he is so adamant that those of us who believe in the health and the life of an unborn child, that we are enemies of the state. I mean, it's a separate issue, but it just points out the absolute hypocrisy and cognitive disconnect of this administration. And it's so frustrating to have to deal with someone like that. Unfortunately, he's a lame duck, and hopefully we will get someone who looks nothing like him, sounds nothing like him, doesn't have his heart, doesn't have his beliefs when we elect our new governor.
I agree. So I will add to this. Yesterday or 2 days ago, We Back to School PA had a check presentation at North Penn High School where we gave a slate of candidates checks. At the very same time, the governor and the teachers union decided to have a press conference as well. Maybe to deter the media, you
deflect
know.
Deflect attention,
it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. So what he did is he had a press conference at Northtown elementary school. And earlier that day, there was an early dismissal for, we are very unsure of the exact things that happened, but the school went on complete lockdown. There was threats, a bomb threat, maybe a possible, like, you know, weapons on campus. The children of the high school were dismissed early. We have video of them jumping over fences to get out.
They Oh, my Lord. Was he aware of this? Was the governor aware of this?
Well, he was there. He was there and continued to have the press conference that we will not shut down schools. There was zero mention in his entire press conference of what just happened 2 hours before to the high school students of Norristown.
Unbelievable.
He was in Norristown.
Oh, my God. He won't shut down when there's a possible, you know, active shooter threat. But he'll shut down because people weren't masking up because he doesn't like what they're doing. This is incredible. Clarice, we're running out of time. How can people reach you? How can they contact you?
Oh, please go to our website, our Facebook, our Twitter, backtoschoolpa.com. On our Facebook and Twitter, it's backtoschoolpa. We'd love to help with any way that we can help any parents, any activists, whatever we have to do. But my main point as I leave a show is November 2nd, you have to go and vote. Know your candidate. Know who you're voting for. These are the people who directly affect our lives.
Amen, sister. That was the great Clarice Schillinger. Thank you so much for coming on, Clarice. It's I'm definitely going to be following your activities in the future. And this is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle and grooving to Al Green on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Tell the bookie, put a bet, I'm not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be all right. Odds are we gonna
Welcome
be
back.
Right.
This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer, filling in for Chris DeGaulle. He will be back on Monday. And right now, I am thrilled because I get to talk to a friend, someone who I really admire, someone who wrote a brilliant op-ed that appeared initially in the Philadelphia Inquirer and also is carried at Broad and Liberty, which, by the way, he is one of the founding members of Broad and Liberty, which we discussed yesterday when Linda Kearns was on air and which I discussed when Guy Shiroki, one of his pieces that we discussed. And oh, goodness else, who else did I talk to? Oh, yes, Michael Torres, who also writes and edits for Broad and Liberty. So this has been the Broad and Liberty week at 990 a.m. But without further ado, I would like to welcome in my friend Albert Eisenberg. And before I get any further, Lashana Tova belatedly, Albert.
Oh, thanks, Christine. Shana Tova to you also. It is said that it is the new year for everybody on Earth, and the world is exactly 5782 years old, 5,782 years old, and that's literally exact. And I appreciate it. I appreciate your generosity in having me and promoting the platform that, that you've really helped build along with us.
Well, I really appreciate the fact, and I talked about this with Linda yesterday, that you guys exist, because really in southeastern Pennsylvania, particularly in the Philadelphia area, it becomes increasingly difficult to hear alternative viewpoints. And that doesn't necessarily mean conservative viewpoints. It just means viewpoints that are not part of the sort of received wisdom or accepted wisdom in the area. So I really appreciate it. And you have so many different voices there. I don't always agree with everything that I see written there, which is perfect, which is exactly what it should be. Instead of...
I also don't always agree as an editor and a co-founder. I also don't always agree. It seems like it's amazing. Even some conservatives seem to have learned the worst things of this censorious, you know, left wing, you can't say that culture, because we get backlash. And my response is always, well, write a letter to the editor or write an op-ed and we'll publish it if it's good.
Oh, I know. That's so great that you said that, because I am as conservative as they come, and I get so angry when I hear some conservatives say, well, you know, you can't do that. Or when they call someone a rhino, a Republican in name only, or when they, I mean, the criticisms are, you're right, they're beginning to sound somewhat Orwellian, and it's bothersome. Who, I don't remember which Supreme Court justice it was. I don't know if it was Brandeis or if it was Holmes, but they basically said that the solution or the remedy or the antidote for speech that you do not like is more speech. It's not censorship. Yes. It's more speech, you know? So anyway,
yes.
So you guys
based
got that
on the ideas of John Stuart Mill, who, you know, influenced, you know, the course of our nation. You know, if you don't like the speech, the answer is more ideas and more speech, and good ideas should win. And that seems, we seem to have taken a very wrong turn in the last few decades in the country. I think it's led by some, you know, left-wing crusaders who have decided they want to control the, you know, debate and not win the debate. And that doesn't mean that we all can learn from them. You know, we can still resist that and try and have a place for dialogue and ideas and intellectual flourishing and sharing stories and news also, not just editorial and voices, but news that is being suppressed and uncovered, such as, you know, the State House Secretary last year moving her mother to a high-end hotel while mandating that COVID patients get put into long-term care facilities, which was not covered by the major newspaper in our
area.
You
guys broke that. Yeah, you guys broke that story.
Broad and Liberty covered it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you broke the story. I mean, you were the first real sort of statewide news site that actually broke that story. You have the great Todd Shepard, who is doing incredible investigative work. So, yes, my love letter to Broad and Liberty. But no, I mean, truthfully, but I didn't call you on to talk about Broad and Liberty. I called you on because I read your op-ed about the Equality Act, and I was bowled over. It was so beautifully written, but it was also, it was just incredibly powerful. So can you walk us through it? First of all, what is the Equality Act?
So thank you, Christine. The Equality Act is an effort, which is really an overreach to, quote unquote, solve discrimination at the federal level against gay and transgender people. Just like, you know, just like there are protected categories based on, you know, race and gender, you can't, you know, not promote your black employees or your female employees. You can't refuse to seat somebody at your restaurant if they come in because they're an interracial couple or because they have a burqa on or because they have a kippah on and they're Jewish. You know, there's non-discrimination categories that are relatively uncontroversial at this point, both at the federal and the state level. And there has been battles raging both in the 50 state houses and, of course, at the federal level, because, you know, the left wants everything to be at the federal level, to basically enshrine sexual orientation, so gay, lesbian, bisexual, and gender identity, which is, you know, a sort of Orwellian term also, of transgender people at the federal level. So it's basically a bill that has a lot of co-signers in the Democratic Party, and I'm not sure, I don't think there are any co-signers, there might be some Republicans, that would basically mandate that these protections are enshrined in federal law, but it goes much further and has some repercussions, such as, you know, there's no carve out for religious business owners who will gladly serve gay customers Monday through Friday, but don't want to, you know, create a custom wedding cake or don't want to, you know, have a same-sex wedding in their facility, which to me, you know, we need a little bit more live and let live. It would possibly punish religious hospitals and nonprofits and charities for their beliefs. And it just goes way too far. And there's another bill called the Fairness for All bill, you know, introduced by Republican Chris Stewart of Utah, which is a compromise. And I like compromise, and I like not, you know, hunting people down and beheading them after we've won the cultural battle.
Sounds Taliban-like, doesn't it?
Yeah, there are illusions. I think that there is a grave moral danger that gay people like myself face, which is, you know, when I was growing up, it wasn't very nice to be gay, and it was still, I was bullied, and there was, you know, and that was even in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And now I think a lot of the gay lobby, the LGBT quote-unquote movement, seems to have decided that we've won the cultural battle and it's time to hunt down dissenters and punish them. And I think that that has grave moral consequences. I think that's bad to do, and that karma is real, and that's, you know, I don't want to be part of that movement. And I also just think it's wrong. I think we need more live and let live, not less, in this country. And if somebody is a religious business owner and treats me with respect, I don't think their business should be shut down because they don't want to perform a custom, you know, wedding cake for my gay marriage. And if somebody, you know, has a spa and doesn't want to have trans women and, you know, regular women in the same bathrooms, I don't think their business should be shut down. And I don't think employers should be hounded. And I don't think, you know, Catholic hospitals should have to give abortions or give birth control. And I don't think, you know, child psychiatrists should be disbarred if they won't give hormone treatments to 15-year-olds. So that is basically what I'm saying in the article, among other things.
And to the listening audience, you really have to read this article. It should still be on the Inquirer website, but go to Broad and Liberty because it's there. Albert Eisenberg, there are fair compromises on LGBT protections, but the Equality Act falls short. You make a really great, even larger point, Albert, which is that people should not be placed under one tent simply because, for example, for me, I'm a woman, and very few of the feminist leaders, very few of the so-called women's leaders speak for me. They don't, because most of them are pro-choice, pro-abortion. I obviously am opposed to that. So many of them talk about wage inequality. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't think the women's soccer team is really a good example of disparity. I mean, they make more than the men. I mean, it's established. They make more money than the men do. But a whole host of different agendas on the part of the so-called women's leaders, women's movement. And I chafe when people say, I'm speaking for women's rights. No, you're not. You're not speaking for me. Equally, you make a great point. Not every person who speaks out for LGBT issues and you know, lobbies for, and is an activist and tries to advance the interests of the LGBT community speaks right for everyone in that community. And it does a great disservice to members of any community, including the immigrant community. I know many conservative immigrants who have a huge problem with some of these immigrant activists out there who, you know, argue for what amounts to open borders. So, I mean, you have to look at, take people as individuals and not just sort of lump them under one tent. Okay, you're gay, so you must agree with this agenda. You're a woman, so you must be for abortion. You're an immigrant, so you don't believe in border protection. It's ridiculous.
Which is a very, very distinct and I don't know if it's subtle kind of discrimination, but nobody ever says, you know, oh, you're white, so you must believe this. They say, oh, you're black, so you must believe this.
Right.
Oh, nobody ever says, oh, you're straight, so you must believe this. They say, oh, you're gay, because you must believe this. I mean, why is that liberating to be, you know, put into a thought ghetto because of your quote-unquote minority status? And it's not like women are minorities, they're the majority of voters, but you couldn't have said it better. The left is expert at sort of propping up these very academic, very radical shifts in policy and cultural policy that they want to enact, and then couching it in language as if they're defending people. So I often find myself in a position where I'm standing up. I'm not saying, you know, there's no discrimination against gay people in this country. There are places in Pennsylvania where there are people who are closeted that if they get outed, they could get fired from their job. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's a moral problem. And I think at this point that's wrong. And I do want to see non-discrimination enshrined with loopholes that allow for some grace and for some live and let live.
Absolutely.
But that being said, I mean, you know, most of the gay people I talk to do not want child therapists disbarred if they're not giving hormone transitions to 15-year-olds. And I do resent being placed in this category, and I did want to speak up because I think it's incumbent upon people who are being told that our rights are being defended by the left to say, no, actually, I have a different view of it. And then I find myself in the very interesting position of, you know, having Twitter battles, as much as I'm willing to engage with them, with people who I assume to be straight because they're not telling me I'm gay too and you're, yes, you know, a Shonda for our community. They're straight people and they're liberals and they're attacking me as if they're defending my community. I'm like, no, I've worked on these issues. It's not like I'm, you know, swooping in and coming in. I know about these issues and I don't agree.
You know, my dear, I've had that same situation where I've had men, you know, condemn me for not defending women's rights. I've had men call me a misogynist. Men have called me a misogynist. I'm looking at this. I'm thinking this is an otherworldly experience over here. I'm having an out-of-body experience. But it's a
level of privilege that's hard to, you know, describe because it's an unquestioned privilege of these people that, you know, these basically white, straight, liberal men with their pronouns in their bio coming at me about LGBT issues.
Yeah. Oh, you nailed it. You put your finger on it. So, what's your next piece going to be about at Broad and Liberty?
That's a good question. I have an interesting piece that I want to write that I'm working on rewilding Philadelphia. Talk about issues conservatives need to engage on. Conservation and environmental issues come top of mind. And there's a concept called rewilding of sort of reintroducing predators like hawks into the area that would naturally eat, you know, pigeons and rats, for example. And there's a few different interesting things we can do in Philadelphia that will help rewild our ecosystem and make our community and our climate better. And I'm really interested in sort of solutions that don't necessarily involve a ton of money, but are creative, will help our environment. So I think I'm going to be working on that.
Oh, I'll look forward to that. I love that word, rewilding.
It's an interesting word. There's some really cool stuff that's happened globally in Europe and stuff, like reintroducing the European bison. And even in Yellowstone, they reintroduced the gray wolf, I think, in the 70s, and it completely changed what kind of trees grow in Yellowstone because of the effects on, you know, the entire ecosystem.
That is fascinating. Well, I'm definitely going to look out for that one. And I thank you so much for the piece that you did write. It was exceptional. Go to Broad and Liberty. How can people follow you on Twitter, especially those who don't want to fight with you?
Well, I won't fight back. So whether or not you want to fight, you know, you can follow me. It's at Albydelphia, Albydelphia, which I assume Christine Flowers has tagged. Recently, I just tagged her.
Yes, I have.
So they could always go to Christine's profile and see the most recent stuff from me. And they can go to Broad and Liberty. We're, you know, running a free-thinking media platform that is the first of its kind in the nation. So broadandliberty.com, join our email list, and donate if you care about it, because we're a nonprofit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Albert Eisenberg, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, and have a wonderful rest of the weekend. You are a mitzvah. I've just used up my three Hebrew words that I know. Shana Tova.
Thank you for your
mitzvah.
Generosity, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Take care. That was Albert Eisenberg of Broad and Liberty, and we are going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Mess with her, you'll see a man get mad. She's my sweet little thing. She's my pride.
Welcome back. This is my last sign off. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Christigal, who will be back on Monday on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Eddie, for everything you've done the last 4 days. It has been a delight, a joy. Love being here behind the microphone with you.
Thank you. You as well, Christine. It's been fun.
It really has. It's been exciting. We've had some incredible guests. You know, tomorrow, obviously, is a very somber, sobering day. It's 20th anniversary of an event that none of us wish ever happened. And it is, as I said, sobering in so many ways. I truly don't want to be divisive. I wish that I could look at tomorrow's anniversary as a way that we could unite and be Americans together the way that we were on 9/11 and on the days after 9/11. But so much divisiveness has been sown by so many people in positions of authority on the right and on the left, but particularly these days on the left, following up on President Biden's speech yesterday about vaccines, he had a visceral distaste for millions and millions of Americans who disagreed with him. And this brings me to an op-ed that Mark Thiessen wrote and that appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And it's today's edition. It's Friday, September 10th. And I know this is going to outrage, the op-ed's going to outrage. Oh, the way that the Inquirer readers are going to take it, they're going to be apoplectic. I think some of you in the listening audience might agree with it. I think he makes a strong point. And the title of the column is, Biden has no business setting foot at 9/11 sites on the anniversary. It's controversial. Presidents have always presided over national tragedies. But the writer makes a very good point. And I want to read just a part of the column to you. Biden has no business setting foot in those sacred places on that hallowed day. I take no joy in saying this. As a general rule, I believe that when a president attends a ceremony on behalf of the American people, he is not representing himself, but the office of the presidency. We respect that office, even if we do not respect the man who occupies it. But this is different. By his dereliction of duty, Biden has abdicated his right to commemorate the anniversary of 9/11. The president who surrendered Afghanistan to our enemies has no business setting foot in Shanksville, where the heroes of Flight 93 launched the first American counterattack. The president who lost 13 American service members by putting their security in the hands of terrorists has no business laying a wreath at the spot where Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. The president who left our citizens and allies behind in Afghanistan and lied to the American people has no business at Ground Zero. His presence would insult the memory of those who died in that sacred place and those who gave life and limb to deliver justice to the enemies who struck us that day. He's right. I think that Joe Biden would do the right thing by staying at home, thinking of his son Beau, in private, with his family, as many of us will be doing. I think that in his rush to have a photo op for 9/11's 20th anniversary, and in his rush to be able to say the war is over, and he got those headlines on CNN over and over and over again, and in the New York Times, and in chyrons at the bottom of the network television programs, the war is over. He got that. But in doing that, he lost 13 members of the military. And there are Americans that are stranded behind enemy lines. And there are allies who, if I have to be honest, will very likely never make it to the United States. For that reason, I agree with Mark Thiessen, but I send all of you my blessings, my love, and my thanks. This is Christine Flowers, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.